The new financial regulation law claims a victim.
Wait a second. Didn't Obama just sign that?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, hello, I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Bill Radke. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Thursday, July 22nd. The new Wall Street rules are less than 24 hours old, and we're already seeing repercussions.
In America, we Google. In China, they Baidu. And feeling stressed about that big trip coming up? You're not alone. But first,
the new rules of Wall Street are less than 24 hours old, and we're already seeing repercussions. Ford Motor has the dubious distinction of being the first company to feel a backlash from lenders who are skittish about the law the president signed just yesterday. Marketplace's John Dimsdale joins us now from Washington. Morning, John.
Hello, Bill.
How is the financial overhaul hitting Ford?
Well, Ford's lending unit, the financing arm, wanted to issue more car loans, but to do that, Ford had to borrow money, and the credit rating agencies are refusing to sign off on any deal. See, Ford wanted to sell bonds that are backed by their auto loans, but those bonds are required to have a credit rating. The new reform law holds the rating agencies more accountable for the grades they give, just because of all the inflated grades that they handed out during the housing boom. Now, under the new law, the agencies can be sued if their opinions don't hold up. So without a rating, Ford had to throw in the towel on its bond deal.
Interesting. And I imagine this would affect companies beyond Ford.
Absolutely. The market for all asset-backed securities, which is $1.4 trillion, is shut down, essentially, for the time being. Now, with credit so scarce, there hadn't been a lot of market activity recently anyway, but it could make car loans, even credit card loans, a bit harder to come by in the short term. But most people figure that this is all going to work out. It's possible that new, smaller credit rating agencies might take a flyer at the new bond offerings, or that the dominant rating agencies, the big ones like Moody's and Standard & Poor's, will eventually put their toe in the new waters and start at least tentatively putting their ratings on asset-backed bonds.
Okay. Marketplace's John Dimsdale. John, thank you.
Thanks, Bill.
Remember, last year, the Obama administration said these companies wouldn't survive without a big infusion of cash. Now, though, more people are buying cars, and Marketplace's Elisa Roth tells us Chrysler Financial is beginning to make money on loan payments.
Chrysler Financial says it never really got out of the loan business, but it hasn't been Chrysler Auto's main lender for a while, and now it says it's looking at originating more loans again. Bill Visnick is senior editor at Edmunds Auto Observer, and he says with banks tightening their standards, there are certainly plenty of opportunities for other lenders.
You know, what you're seeing is a lot of these car companies and the lenders, you know, starting to look at what's going on in this very dynamic sort of environment and say, wow, there are some real openings for us.
The new regulatory environment may be helping, too. John Pato is a law professor at the University of Michigan, and he says consumers may never have such easy access to credit from traditional sources again, which is all the more reason to get into the lending business.
People are buying cars again, and there is still money to be made and sales to be enhanced by having auto lending.
Car loans tend to be safer than other kinds of consumer loans because people are so dependent on their vehicles, they'll make their car payments even if they can't pay off other bills. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Well, now General Motors says it's buying AmeriCredit Corporation for $3.5 billion. David Kiley is correspondent for AOL Autos. He's with us from Ann Arbor, Michigan. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
Now, I thought people weren't buying cars. I mean, why the interest in getting back into auto financing?
Well, you know, it's very difficult for GM, for example, and Chrysler to make car loans to people unless they have control over their own lending institutions, because they have to just go to the bank. GM and Chrysler have been saying they have not been able to make as many loans because of credit being tight, and it's kind of holding back their recoveries.
How much risk is involved in a car loan?
Well, you know, it's funny. Historically, people default on their homes faster than they default on their cars.
Wow.
Because cars are real freedom. I mean, if you live in a place that does not have mass transportation, if you don't have a car, your freedom is cut off. And by the way, I mean, I hate to put it this way, there's an old saying, the reason people default on their homes faster than their cars is they can always live in their cars. They can't drive their homes.
You know, financial reform left a lot of car dealers out because of a loophole. They're not lenders, technically, right?
Right.
If they had been included, would we be seeing this action?
You know, I was disappointed to see car dealers exempted from that bill because, you know, car dealers, listen, there's a lot of great car dealers, but there's also a lot of bad ones. And they often take advantage of poorly prepared consumers, and people wind up signing up for stuff that, you know, that they didn't know or, you know, just aren't prepared for. And car dealers want that leverage during the transaction.
David Kiley is correspondent for AOL Autos with us from Ann Arbor, Michigan. David, thanks.
You're very welcome.
You're listening to the Marketplace Midday Update. I'm Bill Radke. Multinational conglomerates are making money. Should you care? Caterpillar, 3M, UPS, AT&T all say they have improved their profit predictions. We turn to economist Diane Swonk at Mesirow Financial. She joins us every Thursday from Chicago. Hi, Diane.
Good morning.
Caterpillar, 3M, these are huge global manufacturers. UPS ships stuff all over the world. If their overseas business is improving, how much does that help us here where we need it in the United States?
Well, certainly trade has been a critical component, the return of global trade in supporting the global economy and the global recovery. That said, you know, many of the profits that we're seeing on Wall Street are coming without a lot of job gains. So we're seeing profit margins rise and trade improve, and jobs at Caterpillar are being kept because of the situation in global trade. That's the good news. The bad news is we've yet to see many jobs added, and in fact, the downward pressure on incomes that we've seen have actually gone to the bottom line of many profits out there.
Well, yeah, you mentioned job gains. The government said this morning new claims for unemployment benefits rose again significantly last week. So that's just a weekly number. How bad a sign is it? And how much could, if not now, could these emerging economies help our unemployment somewhere down the road?
They're very critical to helping our unemployment down the road. In fact, what we really need to see is China become even more of a consumer, because the only place we're really selling vehicles today, more vehicles than in the U.S., is China and places like that, the developing economies that have all that pent-up demand and have consumers that have yet to really even move into the middle class, let alone be tapped out like we do in the U.S. That said, I think it's really important to understand the unemployment numbers is that, you know, they were artificially suppressed because we had plant closings and we had discontinued a lot of unemployment insurance. People didn't re-up. And now that we've extended unemployment insurance again, a lot of noise in this data going forward. Those unemployment claims are going to rise as people reapply for unemployment insurance that they lost at the end of June.
Okay. Very interesting. Economist Diane Swonk at Mesirow Financial. Thanks for that.
Thank you.
So here is more about this theme of a divide between Wall Street and Main Street. We asked our Wall Street reporter, Jeremy Hobson, to get out of Manhattan and see how Americans are living through this recession. He joins us now from Main Street in downtown Memphis, Tennessee. Good morning, Jeremy.
Good morning, Bill.
How has the recession manifested itself in Memphis?
Well, you know, the unemployment rate here is higher than the national average, but where you really see the recession is when you go into some of the neighborhoods, the residential neighborhoods, and you see one in every three houses on some of these streets are boarded up, the yards are overgrown, they've been foreclosed on. I was in one neighborhood in South Memphis and spoke with a woman named Kim Watkins, who is living in a house right between two abandoned homes, and she says squatters have taken over the neighborhood.
They come in, do all kind of illegal things. That this house just got broken and kicked, the door kicked in because the car was not here. And you're afraid to tell them, leave, you know. They shoot up your houses, all kind of thing. We got kids here, so it's just like jail in your own home, if you ask me.
Wow. Jeremy, that's hard to hear. Who does Kim hold responsible for her situation?
Well, you know, I asked her, who does she blame? And she said that she blames the city for not trying to come up with a way to keep people in their homes. And she also blames the big banks. Now, the city is going after one of the big banks that's been responsible for a lot of the mortgages here in Memphis, Wells Fargo. The city is suing Wells Fargo, saying that Wells Fargo targeted African Americans in Memphis and got a lot of them into subprime loans that when the rates skyrocketed up, people couldn't afford them and foreclosure happened.
Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson is in Memphis and driving through Tennessee. Jeremy, thank you.
You're welcome, Bill.
Listening to the Midday Update for Thursday, July 22nd, I'm Steve Chiotakis. For the latest look at the markets, check out the numbers at our website, marketplace.org. British oil giant BP continues to deal with the effects of the massive Gulf of Mexico oil disaster. Its rivals are learning valuable lessons as well. Four of the world's biggest oil companies say they want to spend $1 billion for a rapid response unit. The BBC's Rebecca Singer reports from Marketplace.
BP isn't the only one that would suffer as a result of stricter regulations on deepwater drilling. So ExxonMobil, Shell, Chevron and ConocoPhillips are committing $250 million each to a system that could be up and running within 18 months. The plan involves building a floating system that could be quickly deployed to a future deep-sea blowout. Victor Shum works for the energy consultants Pervin and Gertz. He says BP's experience has been a wake-up call.
Oil companies certainly have learned from it, and they indeed in this incident demonstrated that the industry was not prepared. Over the long haul, spending will be more than this $1 billion.
Deepwater drilling has been temporarily halted in the U.S. by the Obama administration, and critics say the only reason the companies are doing this is to restore public confidence in the oil industry. But BP isn't included in the plans. The chief executive of Exxon said this was because they didn't want to distract BP as it dealt with its current crisis. In London, I'm the BBC's Rebecca Singer for Marketplace.
Google, of course, is king of the internet search engines here in the United States. But despite the recent battle over its licensing in China, it is still a distant second there to Baidu. Just today, the Chinese internet search giant reported quarterly profits that more than doubled. What does that mean for Google going forward in China? Marketplace's new China bureau chief, Rob Schmitz, reports.
Just ask anyone here walking the streets of Shanghai which search engine they prefer, and it starts to sound like a broken record.
Baidu.
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 That last guy actually had to ask if Google was still operating in China. But forget this unscientific poll. The numbers speak for themselves. 70% of web users in China use Baidu. Google, a paltry 24%. And that number's been slipping since Google's tiff with Chinese authorities this spring. Afterwards, it redirected Chinese users to its Hong Kong site. China internet expert Wen Yunchao says Baidu is gobbling up Google's market share.
Baidu has good business sensibility. It seized the chance when Google pulled out from China, and it's improved its own marketing in the process.
Web users here don't seem to have a problem with one dominant search engine, but the government does. An op-ed today in an online state-run newspaper hammered Baidu for being too cozy with big business. Then again, if Baidu can't take the heat, well, take it from Google. There's always Hong Kong. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
It's been quite a rough patch for professional golfer Tiger Woods, but despite his personal misgivings, his pocketbook is still rather full. Woods claimed the title of 2010's highest-earning athlete in the U.S., according to Sports Illustrated's SI.com. He took home more than $90 million, down 10% from the year before. A lot of people wouldn't have bet on a Tiger comeback, but those who do put money on, say, a golf tournament or a tennis match, are playing into Tony Woodham's game, a sports betting hedge fund. Woodham's Centaur Group started the Galileo Sports Fund just a few months ago. Tony, welcome to the program.
It's good to be with you, Steve.
How does this work?
This works in a very similar way to lots of different funds that you might find in the financial markets. We just analyze sports probability and statistics. And what we're looking for is patterns in numbers that give us an indication of what's going to happen in the future in terms of one team playing another or one person playing another if it's, for example, a tennis match.
So if you were putting money on a baseball game, you would look at a player's stats such as the ERA for a pitcher or maybe a batting average, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I don't know a great deal about baseball, so I don't want to sound as though I do. But if you're in a bar and you're watching a sport and you're watching your particular team and they go they go a few points up in a match. Quite often, if they're playing a certain team in a certain area, you know they're going to concede their lead because it's what they do historically. And we just apply science to that process.
What separates this? I mean, why wouldn't we just call this gambling, sports betting?
Well, do you know what, Steve? I've had this conversation a lot. You can call it gambling if you like. I mean, as long as you apply the word gambling to the process that Goldman Sachs apply when they're trading currencies, then it's the same process. So you can call it gambling, you can call it betting, you can call it trading. It's whatever word you choose to apply. The one thing I would stress about that is that gambling is not a word that should apply to one industry, i.e. sports betting. You know, gambling exists in the financial markets, as we've discovered. My background is derivatives. I traded futures in the City of London and in the US and over in Europe for 20 years. I've worked with hundreds of different traders in the financial markets. Some were brilliant, some were risk averse, and some were just shooting from the hip and taking big risks and were effectively week in, week out gambling. So we don't gamble. I mean, we apply an intelligent process and we look for solid risk-reward opportunities.
Tony Woodhams at the sports betting hedge fund Centaur, the CEO over there. Tony, thank you so much.
Thanks for your time.
They say the most expensive medical device is the doctor's pen. Physicians write the prescriptions and order the labs. And when they're learning their craft in med school, doctors are rarely taught how much those prescriptions and labs cost. From our health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Gregory Warner found a place outside the classroom where medical students learn the cost of care.
Every Thursday night, a couple of dozen medical students from Jefferson University carry plastic curtains and boxes full of pills to a homeless shelter. They set up a free walk-in clinic called Jeff Hope. Christine Feldmeyer is one of the student directors.
So this is our pharmacy.
This corner,
yep. And we have a lot of drugs shoved in here, trust me.
Medical students raise the money to pay for these drugs through campus dances and fundraisers. And then those same students decide which drugs to stock and what lab tests they'll pay for. Last week, a patient came in with all the symptoms of diabetes.
Wounds on his feet, vision problems, a documented history of uncontrolled diabetes for years.
The volunteer resident, the doctor in charge that night, wanted to send out for a lab test called an A1C.
It's a way to measure how uncontrolled the diabetes is.
Standard routine in any hospital. Christine refused the request.
We didn't need a number to tell us, okay, this guy's diabetes is not good.
And you become accustomed to working that way.
Kenneth Hemba, another med student, says taking a patient's history can often be as revealing as a lab test.
And talking to a patient is free.
Practicing medicine on a budget can mean standing up to older doctors that come here to volunteer. Say a doctor is treating a sinus infection.
It's possible that that same doctor might say, oh, and you know, this patient probably hasn't had a cholesterol for a long time, so let's go ahead and order one of those. That's where Christine or I might jump in and say, well, for our care, we're going to address this cold.
Of course, these students don't face the same pressures that doctors do. I asked them if they were worried about being sued.
No. That's never really crossed.
It's a very different setting than in a controlled hospital.
When people come to a free student clinic, they don't expect advanced care or a battery of tests. The one resource that these students do have in abundance is time. Time to really sit and listen to patients. That's something that, after graduation, they won't have that much of. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
And finally, a study by Britain's Institute of Leadership and Management reveals that 80% of workers respond frequently to emails while they're on summer vacation. 40% of them return to the office feeling no more relaxed than when they left.
Wow. Unbelievable. Listeners, please, if you're about to head off to an isolated mountain cabin, remember, you can read me on Twitter at Bill Radke Radio.
And me at Chiatakis MMR.
Mm-hmm. In Los Angeles, I am the aforementioned Bill Radke.
And I'm Steve, Chiotakis. You're listening to the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too.
Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.